Welcome back to the Think Education podcast. I'm Chris Hill, joined as always by Judith Lammy. Things are a little bit more back to normal now, certainly for me in Dubai since the last one. How's your apartment? Is it dried out yet?
Absolutely, it's dried, and wardrobes that were ripped out are being reinstalled, even as we speak.
Fantastic.
So, as you say, things move on, life moves on. Wardrobes that were there and have come out, go back in again. Life's a wardrobe.
Yeah, that's a take on like the Forrest Gump, you know, where life's a box of chocolates, you never know what you're going to get. It's very, very similar.
And we could go down the C.S. Lewis route there as well. That's all I'm saying. How many of us spent quite a lot of time in the back of wardrobes as children trying to find the land of Narnia?
Yeah.
For those of you that still do that, well, just keep trying. That's all I'm saying. I don't want to
What's the character, the first one they meet, the sort of the centaur who's got the books?
Mr. Tumnus.
That's right. So it's international, it's World Book Day here in Dubai. It's been postponed. I know in the kind of the rest of the world it was a month earlier, but it had been postponed, and so it's today. And I was at my daughter's school, you know, early this morning, what, 8 o'clock in the morning, when they did their World Book Day parade, and one of the kids was dressed as Mr. Tumnus, and just an amazing costume. I mean, just... just fantastic. So actually that's kind of an interesting connection. So today it's interesting, I think, because we've got a little bit of a topic to talk about. It leads on from the resilience issue that we talked about last week, and then it morphs into, I guess, in a way, coping with change, sort of innovation and response to things. I attended a conference here in Dubai on Friday and Saturday of last week, so the 19th and 20th of April, at a hotel sort of conference facility downtown. And we got, I think, maybe 70-80% of the total people we were expecting to get. So I was the conference chair. It's the second global conference on research in education and learning. And we had participants from Australia, United States, South Africa, Bangladesh, Turkey, the United Kingdom, Dubai, and UAE, other Emirates. And what was, I think, interesting was, despite the fact that there'd been a lot of flight disruptions coming into the UAE, you know, connecting flights, we'd had some of the participants had been sort of held up with their connection. So from from Cape Town, they'd gone to Nairobi, and then Nairobi they spent a night, and then they'd finally made it to Dubai. And, you know, people had sort of luggage gone, you know, awry because of sort of multiple connecting flights. And they'd still persevered, and they'd still made it. And, you know, when I gave the sort of opening talk at the beginning, I was sort of really reflecting back on a lot of stuff that I've learned from you in the past couple of months about your attendance at conferences, and just the sheer value that we in the community place on the opportunity to discuss and meet and be around other people and their ideas. And, you know, I'd kind of joked that, you know, for many of us in the UAE, we'd had a stay at home kind of advisement for the early part of that week. It had obviously been lifted, but for some of us, the first time we'd actually left our house was to go to a conference. So in a way, we were, you know, this was an important thing that we were willing to do. You know, notwithstanding all the people that have flown in from multiple different countries to share ideas and to learn, and that kind of resilience and that willingness to, no, this is important. Like, I want to learn and I want to engage. And I thought that was really, you know, really fascinating, really very sort of heartwarming that, you know, people had gone to those efforts to make the effort, I guess, right, in a way to be present. And that was really, really very good. A big part of the conversation we had in the conference was about adapting and changing and new issues in teaching and learning and you know, new technologies. And, you know, a lot of it's obviously the advent or the real establishment of AI within teaching. And Executive Dean of Education, Dr. Phil Kirk, he's based at the Higher Colleges of Technology here in Abu Dhabi. He was asking, you know, he asked the question, well, you know, what's your engagement with AI? What's your engagement with it, with, you know, technology? And he's sort of asking most of us though are practitioner teachers, and if not, we're in, you know, administration. And somebody said, oh, I've had about 6 or 7 staff meetings about how dangerous it is. That somebody was me. And he said, yeah, you know, it's funny that our often first response to that is, oh, it's a threat, it's a risk. You know, how, you know, people are going to cheat, how are they going to do this? And that led to a big conversation about kind of risk within universities and you know, how we view challenges and how we respond to them. And I thought that was something interesting that we've talked about in the past, about, you know, the culture of an institution and how it responds to it and how it develops its strategy. And, you know, I was kind of interested to get your thoughts on that. And then one of the really interesting examples was a colleague from Turkey, Alperen Ceylan, Sumeyra Akaya and Kubra Babakan were the 3 presenters, 2 of whom made it despite, you know, real delays. And and they're collectively from the Ministry of Education, in Nonnu University and Ankara University. And they gave this fascinating presentation about, the title was Investigation of Postgraduate Studies on the Use of Origami in Mathematics. And it was partially done to be creative, spatial awareness, you know, actual mathematical type issues. And partially because the academic was saying, well, you can't use AI. You have to, I mean, obviously you could use AI because you could model it, but if you're given a piece of paper, there you go, you've got to actually physically create something, physically problem solve. And that was kind of another interesting perspective about how we problem solve and how we ground things within context. And yeah, it was really just very fascinating event. And I was just so I sort of posit those 2 big areas as kind of possible conversation topics. Do you do much origami in Swansea? Is that a big part of senior management?
Maybe it should be. Focuses the mind, or at least in my case, shows me how inadequate I am when I try to make those little cranes. I did try many, many years ago. Of course, when I lived in Japan, I was always down the local shop by myself, stacks of origami paper, trying to make things and failing abysmally. Interestingly, though, when it comes to, let's not, maybe this is more of a musing on origami than it is the topic at the moment, but anyway, I always found it looked more like a process where actually you were trying to replicate something perfectly that somebody had just done, rather than create something different and innovative. You know, all those little cranes that they hang in Hiroshima and things like that. Absolutely beautiful, don't get me wrong, stunning things, but the whole point was you weren't meant to do something that looked a little bit like it had been damaged in some way, which is what mine always looked as though it was one of those last little creatures in cat protection, unlike ours that we've got here. It's the way you, like, you'd walk past because it got a little bit like Grebo in Terry Pratchett, a bit out of its ear, cut across it. So it looked a little bit like that whenever I did anything. I felt as though I gave it my best, but there was never one that made it to the front of the queue. So, yes, less about sort of maybe something unique and more about trying to do something that was the same as everybody else. But I digress onto the subject of personal reflections on origami, and more maybe back to the essay question, in that it's interesting that the first response to a lot of these things, certainly when it comes to AI, let's say, if we look at that first, and again, just in general reflections on it, is negative. I mean, I've had that as well myself with people who, or other team managers at universities, you know, people in all different walks of life that might be connected to universities. And if they're sort of musing on different sorts of topics and we stumble across AI, the first thing is nearly always, well, what are you doing about it? How are you avoiding it? How are you dealing with it? Mm-hmm. What are the problems with it? Instead of, well, it's a new technology, it could be useful, actually, you know. So that sort of almost fear of something that, I suppose, because most of the people that I now interact with, present company accepted, obviously, Chris, tend to be of a certain age. And maybe more of them than not, not all of them, obviously, but, you know, more of them than not might be slightly concerned about some of the areas of technology they're not fully...
Sure.
They don't fully understand yeah. themselves and they're not fully comfortable with. You know, I mean, people like myself, when I was at school, we had handwriting classes.
Yeah.
You know, we did use chalk and, you know, chalkboards, and we did add up ourselves in our heads, that kind of thing. And we grew crests and stuff like that. I still didn't quite understand why we did that, but, you know.
On the kitchen towel, kitchen roll.
Yeah. You know, like, I'm sure there was a reason. It probably just put a lot of people off crests for life. But, you know, there's that part, though, of, and I suppose, therefore, you know, you will have that aspect with any form of technology that people find disconcerting because they don't understand it, or then maybe they can't use it.
Mm.
themselves, or they don't want to try and use it themselves, and I suppose, you know, so I do not, I have no idea what the, you know, capacity for AI is and what it can do. I scratch on the surface of things when I read about it, a little bit like with computers or with any form of technology. And I remember that as well, and I know we've touched upon this before, but, you know, I remember when they were first invented, put into the classrooms, and people were like, well, that's it, we won't need teachers anymore, we just wheel the computer out to the front of the classroom and, you know, that'll be it, and we can all go and get our P45s. Of course that didn't happen, you know, not least because in most schools there was only one computer and it was wheeled around everywhere, so, you know, it wasn't
yeah.
certainly wasn't prolific. But, you know, there seemed to be those two camps, though, of people. Well, maybe three. There's always a camp that really isn't bothered. Then you've got people who'll be like, oh, this looks like an interesting development. And then you've got those others like, whoa, no, this is this way madness lies. Mm. It's a sort of a Helen Hancock sort of thing, time. And I suppose, thinking about it, you know, clearly there are going to be benefits to the use of any form of technology in any classroom. You've got a young child, you know, in the primary classroom, in the secondary classroom, in the university lecture room or classroom. And I suppose the one thing it does do, which is a benefit on the one hand and can be a challenge on the other, is open up that access to forms of learning, you know, beyond the normal working hours, let's say, whatever they might be, you know. So if a student wants an answer to a question, maybe it's quite a simple one, you know, and they want some tutoring, and, you know, the tutor isn't there, or they've only got a finite capacity, then that can be something that technology can help us with. But, I mean, I wrote a piece for a blog for Happy a little while ago with regard to this, where I shared a number of things, including my fondness for ELO and Queen and things like that. So I shared a bit too much there, Chris, but there you go. But that was about technology and 24/7. And that, on the one hand, it's a very positive thing. On the other hand, we can't all keep going 24/7, and students, when they go home, or kids when they go home from school, they need to be able to relax, don't they? They need to be able to not engage with formal education in some way. So I don't know. So I think there are those positives that we can have, particularly in terms of access. But it is interesting that very often with many of us, the first thing that we think about is the negative implications of anything.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's quite indicative of the way sort of universities are, I don't know, exist or are. I mean, we've talked about this and written about this, you know, that tethered to a certain set of identity or values, you know, or tethered to a place, and, you know, consistent to a cultural reality, and therefore constrained by, in essence, that constructed identity, you know, value-based, good, bad, or otherwise, you know, but it's a thing which governs decisions. And And universities typically are slow to change because, you know, they rely on tradition. And if they changed all the time, it would devalue the credibility. You know, it would underpin, you know, a chunk of what they're trying to do. But at the same time, when we look at what's happening around the world in terms of student movement, recruitment, employability, you know, the role of higher education does need to evolve. I mean, it, we do need to be more aware and more responsive, while, of course, maintaining the integrity and ethics and professionalism and values of the institution. And it's not an easy balance sometimes to take. And we've talked about this in many occasions with different people as well. You know, how do you decide what you do and how do you assess that risk and how do you make those decisions? And how do you balance that reality? Because the risk is real. I mean, we have examples of universities, departments or universities indeed falling or, you know, dissolving because of decisions that were made. It's I think when we look at it over a longer period of time, you're absolutely right that, you know, AI should be viewed as another form of technology, and the internet evolved and the internet added value and it has negative bits. And, you know, I often think that the way we view something, you know, says more about us than about the thing itself. It's a completely rational perspective, isn't it, to be a little concerned or distrustful or wary of something we don't understand. That's human nature in almost every regard, right?
It's almost like, so I was reading something the other day about, you know, what some of the benefits of AI might be, and one of the things it mentioned in there was task automation. Mm-hmm. You know, so teachers, lecturers, whatever, you know, spend a lot of time planning lessons, grading tests, doing admin work, doing all of those things that usually they don't enjoy either. So isn't that something, therefore, that AI could help us with? It could automate, those mundane sort of tasks. We could hand that over to AI, and that's fine, isn't it? Because, there are lots and lots of tests, for example, you know, multiple choice tests and things like that that have always, well, have been done by computers in terms of the grading of them for decades, you know, so there's no reason why they can't look at narrative and text in there as well. But that in itself, I think, is an interesting response, because although I think that's right, why not get, you know, technology to help you with it, it's almost trying to put AI in a very simple little box, isn't it, saying that's all you can do.
Mm-hmm.
You can't help stimulate creative thought. You can't help stimulate innovation. You can't do those things. You can't have empathy.
Mm-hmm.
You can't care. You can't be kind. You can't, because if you can do all of those things, then maybe you're more like us. Maybe you're more human than we can cope with, you know. And that side of it is an interesting one in a way, a different sort of, it's less than about concern about technology enabling students to cheat on tests or copy people's work or, you know, plagiarize and all those sorts of things that, you know,
mm-hmm.
people are worried about. It's less about that, and it seems to be more about going down that route of the replacement.
Yeah.
You know, that if it can do all of these other things, then all of a sudden I might not be needed anymore.
Yeah.
And that's a bit scary, isn't it?
Yeah. No, I agree. I had a conversation with PhD students in a class I was teaching last term about curriculum design and innovation. And so, you know, obviously the use of AI comes up because it comes up in every conversation. They said, oh, well, are we allowed to use AI for writing this or doing that? And I said, well, look, you know, in the abstract, I could use AI to write my module handout, And I could use AI to plan my 10 classes over the term. And I could use AI to set my essay questions. And you could use AI to write your essays. And then I could use AI to mark your essays and give feedback. In which case, we could basically do a 10-week term inside of this first week, right? Because the computer's going to do it all for us. And you'd get your grade and I'd move on. But what would we have learned? Now, if we can use AI for certain efficiency tasks here or there, or accessing information, or you know, generating ideas, but the value, you know, of the engagement in class, supported by something, you know, when I was at university, it was library. You went on the shelf, you pulled out a book, you pulled out a journal, you read it, you cross-referenced it, you went back to the shelf, pulled out another one, and then Google came along and you string searched something or other, and that gave you access to it. So it's an efficiency process that just makes life, you know, providing you know how to use the tool and you don't abuse the tool, then, you know, use it for its purpose, but still have the human engagement and the conversation and the learning that you can get, even if it's prompted by wherever the information's coming from, you know, as long as you're transparent and honest about that. But yeah, that issue of replacement, I think, is... I remember Shirin Miles from the IC Global telling me something really interesting. She'd come back from a conference and she said, "We won't be replaced by AI. Will be replaced by people who use AI," which I thought was I'm not sure that that's not necessarily her quote. She may have heard it from somebody else at the conference, but I certainly heard it from her, and I thought that was so interesting, because, you know, if you can use something that's more efficient, you know, then, you know, I mean, I personally don't, but that's something just within, you know, the structure of what I do. I'm happy for it to be used where it's relevant and necessary. But yeah, it is interesting.
Do you think it can be, Chris? Then, so do you think it can, however, stimulate creativity and interaction and innovation?
So I used it as an example in class where I said to, we sort of split the class in half, and the idea was to develop a new curriculum structure for a particular subject, right? So trying to understand the things that we're in and this and that. And I said, right, well, half of you, you know, you're just going to do it based on what your own knowledge and professionalism and experience. And the other half of you, you know, you can access AI just to pull whatever it is you need to do. And then we'll compare them and see, you know, and see what we've got, and we'll develop it from that. And actually, you know, the material that the non-AI group came up with was essentially the same as the material that the AI group came up with, because they're experts in the field. Now, it wasn't necessarily as fast, right, and therefore not as efficient. But what we then did was we then looked at the AI output and said, right, well, what's missing, or how is it relevant, and what can that lead us to, or is there anything, you know? So it was used as a prompt, in the same way as if you'd had a guest speaker come in and give a talk, or you'd assigned an article, or, you know, it's a prompt and information source. It's not necessarily going to provide information that's revolutionary and never thought of by a group of people engaged in the subject area, but, you know, it will more efficiently provide a prompt that might lead them to something innovative. But that leading to something innovative still relies on their own reflection, interpretation, and understanding of what's been given. The danger, I think, is when you just simply take it and copy and paste it and stick it in and put your name on it, because it's an efficient way of producing content. And that's dangerous, because then that is plagiarism, or it's at least unethical behavior. But using it as a prompt to ask particular questions or this or that, yeah, I mean, that can be quite interesting.
But you can by going to a library and getting exactly a book out of the library, yeah, and copying it. I mean, that's the,
it's exactly the same.
Not AI's fault.
Nope.
What AI does is just speed up the process,
exactly,
means you can cut and paste it in instead of you having to go, yeah, and type it out yourself, you know.
Yeah, so it's just faster. It's,
yes,
not more evil than somebody cheating. What I think I keep coming back to about this kind of issue of, oh, people are going to cheat and people are going to do this, and I think, what does that statement tell us? You know, because it presupposes we assume every student is going to cheat. Like, they've now just been given the secret and they're all going to subvert the system, which is not true. People that are going to cheat are going to cheat. Right? They're going to find a way to cheat. This,
yeah,
just because this is accessible doesn't mean that everybody's going to cheat. You know, if you've got a supermarket or a shop and you've only got one assistant and that assistant is busy, it doesn't mean everybody's going to steal because the assistant isn't looking at them. Like, that's not a natural reality. And if we assume that all students are going to cheat, we should probably be asking ourselves why. What pressures have we created? What system have we engineered such that they need to cheat? Is it because the outcome driven is now so much weighted over, say, the learning experience, in which case they need to get the grade, they need to do this, and so the pressure is so great that they're going to look for the outlet? And if so, I don't know that that's the student's fault. And so I think that that type of question, as you were saying before, it kind of hides kind of the reality maybe behind some of the things we should be thinking about, perhaps.
Mm. Yeah, do you remember? I remember the first time they brought in self-scanning, not for people, I mean, in shops, you know, so yep. You're going around your local Co-op or Waitrose or 7-Eleven or whatever it is in Dubai, you know. And when these first started coming into shops, people were worried in shops as well, weren't they? They were saying, oh, well, people will, if they're getting people to scan things themselves, either at the checkout or in the little
the handheld
gadgets
thing,
and gizmos you got, then what are they might steal loads of stuff. They might not, you know.
Yeah.
And so what they do, of course, don't they, is they've got that, and then you go, well, there's always an individual there. But is it, I've just found it interesting in our local shop here, because there used to be a few of those little scanners, like about not even half a dozen, actually three or four, and then a whole row of people, you know. And now it's flipped the other way, and now there are a few places where you can still go to have a person do it, and the majority of them now, probably there's about 20 there, where you go and you put in the little thing yourself, and you find out what you owe them, and then you. Yep. Put the money in the till, sort of thing. And occasionally it says, this one now needs to get checked, and usually find their husband's age. Sort of goes off on a bit of a strop. And I go, well, they've got to check them occasionally. And then they come and they check it, and it's all fine, obviously. And that in itself is interesting. So I suppose that as well, and it's like you were saying, it's what is your basic assumption about a human being?
Mm-hmm.
Is it somebody that is just trying to do a task,
mm-hmm.
trying to do it as well as they can? Maybe some things can help them. Maybe that can help them to speed up the process. It does mean you can still have people there. The people are still there, but they're just doing different things. Or do you generally mistrust people, and you feel as though, you know, you're going to have to do everything yourself and check everything yourself and monitor all of the essays yourself? Nothing can ever look at them, anything else, because basically, you know, human beings aren't things to be trusted. And there's that element of it, isn't there, as well? And I suppose, you know, finally, too, there's a, and maybe this is when TNE is an interesting look at it, in that when you look at things at scale, so yes, you can do absolutely everything yourself. If you have a tiny classroom with a handful of students,
mm-hmm.
and they're all there, and that's what you're doing there. And you might still access technology, but you all do it together, and you huddle around a computer and you type it together, and that's, you know, fine. And that is the same with a shop. You've got your little corner shop, and you've got Arkwright behind the thing, and you pay them with doubloons, and you put them in a till, and off you go. Or you go to a big supermarket or an hypermarket, or you have, you know, programs that you're delivering overseas where you've not just got 10 students or 20 students. You might have 100, you might have 1,000.
Yep.
You know, what can you do, therefore, then, to help them with the process of learning and teaching, make it a more personalised process, be there when they need you, and they absolutely do need you as an individual, but get technology to help them and to help you when it can be useful, and I suppose, therefore, not be scared of it, you know. But I do think it is an interesting... I will be interested in hearing what other people have to think about particularly about AI and creativity,
mm-hmm.
and innovation. You know, can it help? I see no reason why it can't help promote creativity and promote creative thought. I think sometimes because of all the other things it can do, I don't know how it does it, but then I don't know how all of these things work. But all I know is there are things that now computers, I mean, remember the first time that touch screens came and we were all like, oh, it's so wonderful. And then those of us with cats said, please, how do I turn this off on my computer? Because every time my fluffy ginger cat goes past it with his tail, he wipes off everything I've got on there, you know. But the first time I saw that was in a Tom Cruise movie, I think it was, about something or other, and he was flicking things around a virtual screen.
Minority Report.
I remember thinking, well, that's never going to... There you go.
Yep.
That's never going to happen. And now we're doing it all the time. So I'm not saying that I don't... that I know how AI can help promote, you know, creativity or creative thinking or thinking, you know, well outside the box. But I'm pretty sure it can, because look at all the other things that we can do.
Yeah. I mean, the more informed people are, the more access they have to information, you know, that can spark something. I mean, I think our job is, you know, we've had this debate in my university, as I'm sure many colleagues have had around the world. You know, our role is about, should be about supporting students in the responsible use of AI and technology, because to assume you're not going to use it is false for whatever world they step out into post-graduation, right? They're, you know, they're going to have to be at least aware of, if not expertise. And so to say, no, inside these walls, you can't possibly use that, reinforces that whole sort of ivory tower and, you know, distinct from the real world, etc. So, you know, rather than saying, oh, no, it's something we're not going to talk about, it doesn't exist, etc., it should be, no, it's a tool. Use it responsibly. Be aware of what it is and move on. And now develop your creativity and, you know, your own ideas, etc. So, yeah, I agree with you. I think there's no reason why it is sparking creativity. You know, it is sparking innovation. It's pushing ideas forward and people are making use of the different things. And, you know, so it's here, right?
And maybe if there's somebody out there who listens to our podcast who particularly likes this topic and has got some thoughts on it, maybe they can get in touch and come and chat to us about it. Yeah. That'll be certainly interesting for me, and I'm sure for many of us to hear a little bit about what others might think in terms of AI and creativity.
Yeah, and failing that, we can simply have a conversation with AI itself next time and type in our questions to AI and see what it comes up with. That would be interesting and disturbing at the same time.
Yes, and or we should do that maybe, and then see if our audience can tell when it's us and when it's AI, and they'll go, no, it can't be those two, because we haven't gone from Solomon over here to Shepherd's Pie over there to Origami over here. To, I mean, good luck with that and trying to replicate our conversations, AI.
Yeah, the gauntlet has been thrown.
Gauntlet has been thrown down.
Yes. We've metaphorically slapped AI with a glove across the face, and we await its response eagerly. Yes, or worryingly. Yeah, wonderful. So we've had a little bit of a conversation then about adaptation, resilience, approach to risk, all things massively relevant to universities, kind of in everything that we do, right? So yeah, excellent. Let's see where we go next time.
Next time.